Since 1775, generations of Americans have fought for our ideals and our principles. American warriors secured the freedoms to create the United States of America.
They fought to end slavery.
They joined with allies to win two world wars.
They have responded with valor and honor whenever called.
And they have liberated more people around the globe than any military in the history of the world. Our all-volunteer forces of guardsmen, soldiers, sailors, marines, airmen, and reservists continue the mission begun at Lexington and Concord.
Less than 1% of Americans serve in our armed forces.
The least the rest of us can do is to pay attention and get engaged. This program is produced and broadcast for that purpose. It is presented live and worldwide
at 1041kqth.com.
To engage, call 520-751-1041. The American Warrior is on the air.
Good afternoon, Tucson, and those of you listening around the globe on the internet. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Welcome to another episode of American Warrior Radio. Let's start with some history. You know, in 1862, President Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation. The U.S. Senate passed a constitutional amendment abolishing slavery in 1864, but it died in the House of Representatives that year, defeated by Democrats rallying in the name of states' rights. On January 31, 1865, the U.S. House of Representatives finally passed the 13th Amendment. President Lincoln forwarded it to the states for ratification, and on December 18, 1865, the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery in our nation became law. On January 31, 1945, Private Eddie Slovak became the first U.S. soldier since the Civil War to be executed for desertion. And this week, 30 years ago, January 28, 1986, the Space Shuttle Challenger broke apart 73 seconds into its flight at 11:39 Eastern Standard Time, resulting in a loss of the entire crew. Now, be sure to tune in next week. Our guest is Frederick Gregory, who commanded a space mission as a commander aboard the Challenger and was in mission control when that disaster occurred. Should be a very interesting interview. Let me tell you about Staff Sergeant Jonah E. Kelly from Rota, West Virginia. On January 30, 1945, Kelly was leading a squad of the 78th Infantry Division in furious house-to-house fighting. He led his men through mortar and small arms fire and repeated assaults on barricaded houses. Although twice wounded, once in the back and by shrapnel that left his left hand practically useless, Kelly refused to withdraw and continued to lead his men after field dressings had been applied to his wounds. His wounds forced him to fire his rifle with one hand, either resting it on rubble or resting it on his good forearm, and to blast his way through the enemy with grenades, he set his rifle down, pulled the pin with his teeth, and threw the missile with his remaining good arm. Despite his handicap, Sergeant Kelly wreaked havoc among the enemy troops, rushing from one house to the other, and one killing three enemies with his rifle. Approaching another house, he was fired from upstairs window and dispatched the sniper with just one shot. When darkness came, he assigned his men to defensive positions, but again refused to leave them to seek medical attention himself. At dawn the next day, his squad resumed the attack. When they were stalled by heavy fire, Kelly moved up alone, located the enemy gunner dug in under a haystack, and killed him with rifle fire. However, upon returning to his men, he found that a German machine gun firing from a well-protected position in a nearby house was still holding up the advance. Ordering his men to stay under cover, Sergeant Jonah Kelly dashed into the open and attacked the position single-handedly. Struck by several bullets, he fell to his knees 25 yards short of his objective. But summoning his remaining strength, he emptied his rifle into the machine gun nest, silencing the enemy gun. He then collapsed and died. For his actions that day in the village of Kesselnecht, Germany, Army Staff Sergeant Jonah E. Kelly was posthumously awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor on September 10, 1945. Now, folks, you know that occasionally here we feature guests from the Havoc Journal. You can visit their website, havocjournal.com. Today's guest is recently retired from the Army Special Forces. He served both as an Army Ranger and then as a member of the elite Green Berets. Now, like some of our other Havoc Journal guests, he writes under a pseudonym, a pen name, or a nom de plume for you sophisticated types out there. So don't try researching Army records for Tyler Mack. You won't find him. So, Tyler, welcome to your first appearance on American Warrior Radio.
Ben, thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Are you sure? Now, Tyler, I want to apologize. I do some dumb things, one of which was kind of busting your chops about appearing on American Warrior Radio. Generally not a good idea to threaten a Green Beret.
Well, we take it all in good stride, and, you know, we enjoy a good sense of humor and a good joke. So you can't survive in the team room if you don't have a sense of humor.
Well, I tell you, Tyler, I really enjoy the stuff you've written on Havoc Journal. Just to establish your bona fides here before the first break, tell us about your Army service briefly, that you can share with us.
Yeah, absolutely. So I recently left the Army after 10 years and 10 months. Graduated from West Point, was commissioned into the infantry, spent my first 5 years in the military doing that, and then my last 5 years going through the Special Forces Qualification Course and serving on a Special Forces Detachment in 3rd Special Forces Group. So, in that 10 years, I've had 2 deployments to Iraq, 1 deployment to Afghanistan, not as many as a lot of folks and a lot of my peers that I've served with, but I was definitely fortunate to go downrange and get into the big game, you know, as I call it, and serve my country. So, 7 months ago, I began writing for Havoc Journal, and I've just continued that. And it's a passionate group of writers, veterans, and supporters that really enjoy telling people about our experience and sharing that experience with others.
Well, I'll tell you, Tyler, one of the other folks at Havoc Journal, another gentleman who comes on the show regularly who doesn't use his real name either, which I kind of get a kick out of, when he recommended you, I really enjoy the stuff you write. We're going to start off with your article that you called The Things That I Carried, Or Did They Carry You? It was such a wonderful piece. Just to sort of tease folks, you start off by referencing the little things. Waterlogged copies of your Ranger handbook in a small service Bible, a journal and a fountain pen, a P-38 on your dog tags. Now, you and I and maybe some of our older listeners are the only folks that know what a P-38 is. So let's just start off with that. What on earth is a P-38?
Well, a P-38 is a small metal device that's used to open C-ration cans. So generation going all the way back to World War II, you know, to the present, and through Vietnam, you can still find those in a lot of military surplus stores, but that's how you would open the can. And I tell you, for the folks out there that may be prepping for a big winter or something like that, that's an invaluable survival tool, because you can also use it to cut cordage and, you know, do some other things, but it's quite useful.
Well, I tell you, the reason I was busting your chops, when I was in the fighting forest fires, I think the rations they gave us were Korean War vintage. By the way they tasted, but that was back before MRE, so we got pretty proficient at a P-38, so I'd challenge you to a P-38 contest. Are you still up for that?
Yeah, well, game on. Challenge accepted.
Game on. Ladies and gentlemen, we're joined by Tyler Mack. He writes for the Havoc Journal. You can read their journal at havocjournal.com. Tyler, when we come back after the break, I want to talk a little bit about West Point. You mentioned you're a West Point graduate, and one of the first things you referred to in this article is kind of a hiccup at West Point. So that's okay with you. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, will be right back after these messages.
Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, here on American Warrior. We're joined on the phone by Tyler Mack. That's not his real name. He's a recently retired Green Beret officer. He writes for the Havoc Journal. You can read his stuff at havocjournal.com. That's Havoc, H-O-V-O-H-A-V-O-K. Tyler, we're talking about your piece, The Things I Carried, and I just thought it was wonderful because you talked not, you know, we're kind of joking around about a P-38. You were talking about not just the things you carried, but maybe some of the things throughout your Army career that then carried you on in life. And one of your first references to that you had was the pain when you notified your parents that you're failing at West Point. Tell us about Craig Whiteside.
Well, first, I'd like to say that to your listeners out there, thank you for listening. Thank you for reading, Ben. This is a great show, and thank you for what you do supporting our community. My time at West Point, I'll put it to you like this. Most of the stress that I experienced there was self-imposed. It is a military academy. It is supposed to be hard and challenging, but I did not take that laser-like focus that I developed on later on in life to my academics. I was physically fit. I enjoyed the military side of it, but to anybody, any of your listeners who have family members or who they themselves are considering applying to a military academy or they are going this summer, focus on your academics first because that will open a lot of doors for you later on. So Craig Whiteside at the time was a captain, and he was one of the TAC officers there who mentors the cadets in their various cadet companies. It's organized like a typical military unit with active duty officers and non-commissioned officers, NCOs, mentoring the cadet chain of command. And one semester I failed a lot of classes, and it was very hard for me to stand up in front of him and be told that I was going before an academic board because, as I wrote about in that article, just a year and a half prior, he had been with my squad during cadet basic training and then put himself as a squad member because we had about four or five people injured. And he wanted us to have the, full team and a full experience. And that really taught me the value of leadership, especially leadership by example, by quiet example. So it was a little bit emotionally traumatic for me to stand up in front of a man that I deeply respected and be told that potentially I was going to get kicked out. And then all the residual effects, talking to my parents as a young 19-year-old about that.
Mm-hmm. But you learned the power of second chances.
I absolutely did. And I my hat's always off to General Eric T. Olson and to Brigadier General Daniel Kaufman, the Commandant and the Dean, who allowed me to stay and repeat my sophomore year there. That's a very rare occurrence, and that's not a technique that I would advise anyone of doing. Again, Captain Whiteside told me that I was going to repeat my sophomore year to pack my stuff up for the summer and to give me a report back date. And I took that second chance, and I ran with it, and I made sure I graduated.
And you were commissioned in the United States Army. And then the next, and frankly, there's just too much here to cover. It's all very good. I encourage the listeners to go read your blog or your journal there at havocjournal.com. But when you talk about the things you carried, some of them were psychological things, at least the way I interpret it, Tyler. One was a joy, the dream of every second lieutenant taking over a platoon in combat. Where was that, and what action was that when you took over that platoon?
That was in 2006 in July, and I took over a platoon that was in southern Iraq, I would say south central Iraq, south of Baghdad. And they were already 6 months into their tour of duty. I was coming on after Ranger School, and it was a platoon with the 4th Infantry Division. Originally, my intent was, again, for your listeners, there's differences in the infantry. Particularly light infantry, mainly foot, and then mechanized infantry with large, big vehicles and big guns. I'd never particularly looked into going into the mechanized side, but once I was there, I was just happy to be there and, learned very quickly that having big guns and a big vehicle in a fight is definitely better sometimes than just having your rifle with you. So,
you went from the dream, kind of, I don't want to say the joy, but the thrill of leading men in combat, to right away both a psychological burden and a physical burden, to carrying your first dying man to a medevac bird.
Absolutely. And that was a month after I was in country, and it was a four-hour firefight, and my men performed incredibly well. And that joy, I still experience that joy because everything that I had been told about the U.S. Army infantrymen and U.S. Army soldiers proved true. They were great soldiers and aggressive and wonderful. But at the same time, that was our area of responsibility, and for somebody to die on that, on that stretch of road that we were responsible for, it hit home that this was, I never thought it was a game beforehand. My father was a Vietnam veteran, and before him, World War II veterans and things like that. So I knew it wasn't a game, but it really hit home as we were carrying that guy on the stretcher to the medevac helicopter, and that was hard, but we just we went back to our base and we talked about it and reviewed the mission. We went back out the next day and kept doing our job.
And Tyler, you knew when you were carrying him to the bird that he wasn't going to make it, huh?
We didn't know that for certain, but there was he was very severely injured, and we found out the next day that he had passed away. It was very unfortunate.
Okay. next, at this time you were a member of the Rangers, which is pretty darn elite to begin with. But then you saw a Special Forces Operational Detachment pulling out of the base, and that led Tyler to his next step in life. And what was that?
That was becoming a member of Special Forces and earning a Green Beret. And just to clarify, I went to the Ranger School and the Ranger Course. I earned the Ranger Tab, but I never actually served with the Ranger Regiment. Infantry officers and combat arms officers typically go to the Ranger School. So I was in the 4th Infantry Division, a mechanized division, great division to be a part of and a great time. But you're right, when I saw that Special Forces team pull out of the gate with their Iraqi counterparts, I looked at them and I said, that's what I want to be like and that's what I want to go do. And it wasn't because I wasn't enjoying what I was doing at the time. I saw what they were doing with just the small amount of forces they have, and they were having a very big impact supporting everybody in our area of operations, and it looked like a lot of fun.
And looking back on it, was there something in particular that struck you? Was it because they were able to grow facial hair, or?
No, you know, really not. And I'll tell you, as a Green Beret, I'm a bit of an anomaly because my beard growing abilities are a bit suspect. I manage a goatee, and that's about it. But what really did it for me was the large impact they had with just a small force and how often they were with their Iraqi counterparts. It was constant. It was all the time. We had an Iraqi police force that we were partnered with, that we enjoyed spending time with, we enjoyed training with. But it was all those other hours of the day, the meal times, the evening times, the training times, where we weren't necessarily with them. And at the time, and I still do, I really believe that troop partnership has to be a true partnership, and you have to live with them, eat with them, you know, share the same quarters, share the same stories, make good attempts to learn the language, and I read more on it, I read more books on it, and decided that that's where I was going to go, and I was at least going to give it a shot.
Now, Tyler, we've got about 3 minutes, but I really want to touch real briefly, and we can carry this over the break, because there's really two things I want to bring up here. So often, I think some of us out here get the image of our Iraqi or our Afghan allies that is not ideal. Let's just put it that way. But you make two references in your article, one of which is on, you know, what's called the Alive Day, and you talk about an Iraqi policeman who
right.
you hope to meet someday in Valhalla. Tell us, we got about 2 minutes, tell us quickly of his story.
Well, the short version of the story is that we were hit with a large suicide bomb that was in a dump truck. And the Afghan policeman who really saved our lives that day, he noticed that something was wrong because the truck and the truck driver didn't look right in our area. And he stopped the truck driver. Unfortunately, there was an Afghan with a suicide vest who was walking up behind him. He detonated his suicide vest, killed the Afghan policeman, but that was able to give us enough time to alert, to react to the situation. Thankfully, that large dump truck bomb didn't blow up, otherwise I wouldn't be here talking with you today. And he was really brave in doing that, because he knew the consequences. They all knew the consequences of you know, potentially working with us and fighting for their own country. So he's a brave soul, and I know someday that we're gonna meet.
Well, and I tell you, I'm glad you mentioned that. And I wanted to make sure to bring it up too, because I think sometimes folks that may just believe what they see on TV or read in certain articles don't give our allies there, these brave people of those countries that we're trying to help out, the credit for just being brave and the sacrifices they're making.
Yeah, he was extremely brave, and the forces that we worked with, we were always excited to train with them because they were motivated for the most part. You know, it's very true. You know, my views, you know, aren't the Department of Defense views or the Department of Army views, but there's good units and there's bad units out there. It's the law of averages, you know, and law of statistics. So the units that we worked with, thankfully, were motivated, willing to learn, and became very, very good by the time we left.
There you have it, folks. This is your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. I'm joined by Tyler Mack, one of the writers for the Havoc Journal, a retired Green Beret. Tyler, when we come back, want to chat about Nassim. Folks, stick around. Great interview. We'll be right back. Give us a call, 751-1041.
Who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back, folks. Your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. I'm joined live on the phone by our guest, Tyler Mack. He writes for the Havoc Journal. You heard the Cervezas ad. So what that means is that brings us to our Cervezas, sir, yes, sir.
Sir, yes, sir!
Question of the day. You like that, Tyler?
Yeah, that's good. That's a good one.
There you go. First caller gets a $20 gift card to Cervezas. You've got a great guest here, a great resource. Give us a call, 751-1041, with a question for our guest, Tyler Mack. Tyler, before the break, we were talking about Nassim.
Right.
And tell us about that young man and his family, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, Nassim was one of our Afghan interpreters, local national interpreter, in his 20s. And about 3 weeks after me and my Special Forces detachment redeployed home, Nassim was killed by a roadside bomb. And that really hit home for us in many, many ways. It's, you know, what really hurts me, and again, you know, I speak for myself and not for, you know, the Department of Defense or the Army, you know, or their current policies, but it's unfortunate that more of our interpreters who've worked with us, especially on the local national side, are still having troubles getting visas. One of our fellow writers writes about this, trying to obtain a visa for his interpreter, Dave.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Save Dave campaign, and I encourage anybody who's listening to check that out on the Havoc Journal and to read Dave's story, because it's very, very similar. These interpreters are putting their lives, their family's lives at risk, you know, to help us and help their country. And it was a big deal. And Nassim was he was a funny young man. He was always always drinking chai tea, and his English was actually really good, but he was always I wouldn't say agitated, but always high energy.
Well,
he was a lot of fun to be around. And so, you know, hearing that he was killed along with some of our former Afghan counterparts was that was a hard pill to swallow.
Well, I tell you, I don't have to do a disclaimer. I'm a civilian, so I'm glad you mentioned that in your article, because that's always frustrating me. These people are allies who do, you know, who serve and support and are out there on the front lines with you. And just given, you know, it would be one thing if their countries were all nice and stable and it was just like Kansas. But darn it, I sure wish that we as a nation would do more to bring these folks back with us. So thanks for mentioning that, Tyler, and thanks for lifting a cup of chai tea to Nassim every once in a while. I think that's a very powerful statement. Okay,
absolutely.
We've got the winner of our Cervezas, Sir, Yes, Sir, question of the week. Dennis, you've got question for our guest, Tyler Mack.
Hey, Tyler, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you, Dennis? Good to talk with you.
Yeah, same here. Tyler, I was going to ask you about our POW MIAs. Are we doing everything we can to bring them back?
As far as the POW MIA issue, I truly believe myself, based off what I know, what I've seen, what I've experienced, that we are. I really do. Now, you know, my father's a Vietnam veteran. It was a very passionate topic for him, you know, in his generation, you know, and I know that cycles all the way up now to, you know, the current Bo Bergdahl case, which I know, Ben, is an issue you've talked about on this radio program, specifically with my editor in chief. You know, a couple of times, I truly believe that we are doing everything that we can. And I will say that that I truly believe that we have to, because going to war is not an easy thing. War is an ugly business. And if you've ever been through any type of survival training, either in, you know, the forestry industry, the outdoor tourism industry, or in the military, at one of the survival schools, you learn one of the things that you learn is that your country's always going to come back for you, and they're always going to do everything that they can to get you home. That's important for the soldier to know, the service member to know, and it's important for their families to know. And I truly believe that we do whatever it takes to bring our service members home.
Wonderful.
That's good to hear from you rather than a politician. I have some belief in it when I hear from you.
Dennis, thanks for your call.
Thank you for the question, Dennis. Thank you.
And Dennis, stay on hold. Rhea will get your information. We'll mail that card out to you. And again, thanks for listening to American Warrior. And Tyler, that was not designed. That was actually fortuitous. But it's a great transition into the things I want to talk to about next. You know, I call it sandals on the ground. Frustration at from reading your articles, blunting the tip of the spear, and then your other article, "Dear Congress, please formally declare war this time." I sense that you are growing increasingly frustrated with the political tendency towards plausible deniability. And, you know, with Dennis's call and POWs, you talk about Master Sergeant Joshua Wheeler, who was with Delta Force. He was killed October 22nd, combat against elements of ISIS during a rescue mission. And so when I hear folks in a leadership position saying, oh, we don't have boots on the ground, and yet Master Sergeant Wheeler lost his life and his family is paying the price, are we at war with ISIS or not?
Well, I'm not going to answer that question specifically in a yes or no, because that's way above my pay grade. But here's my take on that issue. As far as specifically, you keyed on that specific word war. Like, what is that word? That is that's a very powerful word. Excuse me, because if we formally declare war, then we have a line of funding. So sequestration and other funding issues that have happened over the last decade and a half, those problems go away. We have a set line of funding. It's approved by Congress and the National Command Authority, which means the entire, basically, whole of government is behind. And I know that's a term that's thrown around a lot, but that whole of government is really into that war effort because it's formally declared. And then the third thing is that a lot of the legal issues surrounding detainees and other, you know, prisoners, that issue, it doesn't go away, but it's made simpler because there's rules, that there's set international rules and international norms that go along with war. And so the current issues with Guantanamo Bay, I don't necessarily know or believe that that would be entirely fixed with a formal declaration. However, I do know that formally declaring war against, you know, say, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, anybody who would be captured on the battlefield would now become a prisoner of war. They'd have certain rights, certain treatment, but we'd also be allowed to hold them until the duration of the conflict is over, or until we see fit to release them. So, you know, in my mind, just as, you know, having studied in graduate school and some other things, you know, from my viewpoint, from where I sit, it would make things easier. And then the fourth thing that it would help is just a national strategy. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I wrote about in that article concerning the formal declaration of war was disrupt, degrade, and defeat. You know, sometimes that's not enough, especially against a worldwide terrorist organization with various subsets and subgroups within that. So instead of trying to take down the whole terrorist apparatus, which, you know, is an act of, you know, anybody can really sort of form a group and start using, you know, terrorism as a tactic. You go after the leadership, you go after the finances, you go after that main organizational structure that is sort of the vanguard of, you know, sort of the vanguard of terrorism, say Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State. And so a formal declaration, you know, allows for us to formulate the national strategy, you know, and potentially helps make it easier for an international strategy and an international coalition to occur that's funded and that has clear goals, objectives, and aims. Because it's, you know, again, from where I sit, 15 years is still a long time to be doing this. And you know, and even General Petraeus said at one point in 2007, he said, you know, he told a reporter, he said, tell me how this ends.
Yeah.
And sort of left the question open. And in a way, we're still trying to answer that question.
Well, you know, and then I kind of equate it to it's like being kind of pregnant. You either are or you aren't. We're either at war, and again, just my personal opinion, we're either at war or we're not. Folks, my producer, Rhea, just chastised me. You know, you can call any time, 751-1041, and talk with our guests. You don't have to just do it when you're winning something. So we've got about 10 more minutes with our guest, Tyler Mack, who writes for the Havoc Journal. Visit them at havocjournal.com. He's recently retired Army Green Beret. Just a great, great writer, great guest. Tyler, when we come back, I want to pursue this idea a little bit more. Congress has only formally declared war 11 times, only three of which were not associated with World War I or World War II. So I want to kind of get your sense of opinion if America has lost the taste for real war and what that means. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. I'm joined by Tyler Mack of the Havoc Journal. We'll be right back after these messages.
Tucson's News and Talk, 104.1 KQTH.
My daddy served in the Army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard. Till the day that he died, he wanted my mother, my brother, my sister and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free.
If you want to discuss those who serve the red, white, and blue, dial 520-751-1041. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back, folks. Your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, here on American Warrior. We're joined live on the phone by Tyler Mack. That's not his real name. That's the only disclaimer I'll issue, Tyler. But he is a retired Army Green Beret, recently retired. And he also writes for the Havoc Journal, one of my favorite places to visit on a daily basis, havocjournal.com. Tyler, it's kind of my opinion, but just you sort of get the sense that as a nation, have we lost, war is a messy business. Have we lost the appetite? I mean, do you have a thought on that?
Wow, that is a very deep question that could probably take a whole another hour.
Well, okay,
I'd be more than happy to stay on with you and discuss it.
Well, I tell in that case, let's skip it because I got a caller here and I want to get on to some other things real quick.
I can actually address this one in about 30 seconds.
Okay, go for it.
Have we lost the appetite for it? No. However, there's a way to go about doing it. Currently, we're using yearly funding authorizations with the Defense Department, with Congress, to authorize funds to do our business and to do what we need to do to, protect our nation, protect our interests at home and abroad. At a certain point, my viewpoint, a formal declaration of war seriously needs to be put on the table to allow us to actually, as the 1941 Declaration says, use all of the resources of the country and to bring the conflict to successful termination.
Okay. Well, and that got him going. We got the lines lighting up here, Tyler. It's interesting in your article, blunting the tip of the spear, you actually say, and I quote these words, can we stop pretending we are not at war, at least that our special forces aren't at war? Let's go to caller Suzanne. Suzanne, you had a question about declaring war and whether that would actually change policy.
I may be mixing the two issues up, but if we did declare war, would that help us get terrorists out of this country?
I'm sorry, Suzanne, I'm having trouble hearing your question.
Okay. My question is, if we declared war, would that help us get terrorists out of this country?
That's an interesting question because I'm not exactly sure that the terrorist forces are here now. It's a very debatable topic. There are people that are angry with the United States who do live on U.S. soil. That's very true. And there are people who are angry with various facets of it, be it from a religious standpoint or a government standpoint. What I truly believe a declaration of war would do is that it would galvanize the country, galvanize the military, put that whole of government approach towards a specific problem and help us solve defeat and get rid of that problem, at least in that one subset, say, specifically against Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State. How that's done, it's going to take a long time. It's going to take a lot of money, a lot of resources, and unfortunately, potentially a lot of blood. So it's a very serious issue and one that needs to be discussed. But as far as here at home, I fully believe that we protect our interests at home and abroad, and we're doing a fine job of it so far.
There you go, Suzanne. Thanks for your call. Tyler, thanks for addressing it. That was a tough question. I heard a general quote once that he always wanted our wars to be away games. We don't want to fight games at home. And I would propose that if we were doing a better job overseas, then that might help stabilize things here on the home front. What, in your article, when you talk about blunting the tip of the spear, though, and you mentioned Master Sergeant Joshua Wheeler.
Right.
He had been on 14 deployments. You say that on average now our special forces are looking at anywhere from 6 to 10 deployments. We're talking combat action. And you use the phrase performance punishment. Can you just kind of expound on that a little bit, Tyler, what you mean by that?
Sure. Performance punishment is a phrase we use in the military sometimes where somebody's really good at their job, so you give them more work. Because you know it's going to get done right, it's going to get done well, and you got a strong performer that you can always count on. When you do that in a sense of repeated combat deployments, that performance punishment comes with a cost. Because when special forces, special operations soldiers hurt, wounded, killed, all that experience is lost. The family and the community obviously suffers. And we really, you really have to start to look at the sustainability of the repeated deployments. I mean, soldiers that I've worked with, they've been going to war since 2001, since the beginning. And that's, 2016 when, they've had kids and now their kids are looking at joining the service and they're wondering, they're asking themselves, and I would be too if I was a parent, is my son or daughter going to be in this conflict? Are we going to be in this together? And how much more sacrifice am I and my family going to be asked to make? And that's a hard question to ask. And I think it's one of those questions that we need to discuss as a country. I recently sort of talked about this with some of our writers, that potentially the best way to support a veteran might be to become one.
Mm.
And that's hard. And I don't mean that in a flippant sense. And I don't mean that the country hasn't done a great job of supporting the military. They have. But we're always in need of volunteers and we're always in need of good people, who can answer the call, who can step up when, at this time and do, in a sense, fill the void that is left by great men like, Master Sergeant Wheeler. I did not know him personally, but I've known, many other good men who I wrote about who have died, and it's hard.
Well,
to see this being sustained year after year after year and going to those funerals and the memorials. It's a difficult fight that we're in. So, I have no doubt that special operations can continue the fight and we'll continue to do our best to win. But at a certain point, with repeated trips overseas, you start to, that law of statistics and rolling the dice. It's a very dangerous profession.
Well, and Tyler, that's why I'm so glad you brought it up and your article, Blunting the Tip of the Spear on Havoc Journal, because that's one of my concerns is that even with the best blade, if you're constantly using it, it eventually gets dull and can break. And I don't know, just to me, it seems so much more convenient. Special forces have got very broad soldiers and they're still the best in the world at what they do, but you keep going back to the well over and over and over again. Eventually that's going to wear folks down. Now, Rhea, keep your finger by the dump button just in case, because our next caller, Lance, he's got a question. He's using a word I don't recognize. Tyler, maybe you do. Scut work, is that right, Lance?
Scut work. Scut work is, cleaning up the garbage.
Okay. So what is your question for our guest, Tyler?
My question for you, as an old POW, a real old one.
God bless you, Lance. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome.
Lance, thank you for calling in. It's an honor to talk with you.
Well, it's my honor. I'm curious about something. When you fellows deploy and you pick up an interpreter that stays with you, as perhaps during the complete, term of your deployment, then you have to go home and you leave this poor beggar back there to have happen to him and his family whatever is going to happen. Now, my question is this. When you guys get ready to pull out and come back home, and I assume you ask your commanding officer, can this be done? But how high up the chain does this go, and why doesn't it go to the top of the frigging chain?
Okay. Thank you for that, Lance.
That's an easy question to answer. The process for getting a local national back to the United States, it's the visa process. That goes through, the State Department, as well as, immigration, and Homeland Security. So with the paperwork that's involved in that, that's a very long, difficult, and arduous process. I mean, we're talking years. We're talking at least a couple of years. And that's just to allow that interpreter to come over to the United States. That doesn't, you know, that doesn't equate to citizenship or anything else like that. So it's, you know, it's a very hard topic, and I can hear the passion in Lance's voice, you know, and I've spoken with other Vietnam veterans who feel that way about the Hmong people, you know, and some of their South Vietnamese counterparts that, you know, they feel like they left them behind, and it's hard not to feel that way. You know, there's a lot of, there may be a lot of guilt there.
Yeah.
You know, that I feel from time to time, and that's, you know, we'll keep doing our best at it, and the best thing that we can do is to keep educating people about it, keep writing about it, and to keep, you know, to keep on top of it. Recently, one of my classmates was able to bring his interpreter to the United States after a long 2-year process, and I was so happy for him. So it does happen.
Good.
And it's getting faster. So
good stuff. And Lance, I just want to clarify, we meant no disrespect to you. Just had to. We're running out of time here. I'm down at the end of the show. Tyler, let me just let you know that you made it. I'd love to have you back on again sometime. I know there's a lot of stuff we didn't cover. Ladies and gentlemen, visit havocjournal.com. Look for Tyler Mack. This has been your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Check us out on Facebook, American Warrior Daily Mail, on Twitter, at Warrior Radio TUC. You can always find the podcast, 1041kqth.com. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, all policies and procedures are to remain in place.